Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist with the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy.
And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Andrew.
Today we welcome musician, singer, and songwriter Pat Badger, best known as longtime member and bass player for the rock band Extreme. Pat is also known and as a member of Dark Desert Eagles and also played in Tribe of Judah, among other projects. Extreme has sold over 10 million records. And they released their album Six in 2023, which is a really great record. We're going to dive into that at the top of the show here. So welcome to the Music Buzz, Pat Badger.
Hey, it's nice to be here and nice to meet you guys.
Yeah man. It's great to talk to you.
Via the magic of the internet and these Zoom calls.
That's a beautiful thing, all right?
Speaking of beautiful thing, the new album, holy shit, it's really beautiful.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
It's incredible how you seamlessly move from you know, the well-crafted, you know, harder stuff into the beautiful melancholy, you know, all with great arrangements and good lyrics and really good vocals too, you know. And the bass player is pretty good too.
Well, I'm fortunate to be in a band with some really great musicians and talent.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, you're amazing. Yeah.
I think everyone's equally adept in your group, that's for sure. And what a wonderfully eclectic batch of tunes too, man. I read a press release where one of you guys said, I'm not sure which one, that true Extreme fans know to expect the unexpected, and boy, that's for sure on this record.
Oh yeah, that's for damn sure. Yeah,
it's you know, I've got a list of almost every song that I have things to say about, to talk about. I was incredibly impressed.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thanks.
It, coming out of the gate with Rise, too, man, that's relentless, as relentless a prog rocker as I've ever heard. I mean, it's furious. It's absolutely insane guitar break there in the middle. Great arrangement. I love the in and out of the halftime feel on the drums and, you know, the rhythm section's just smoking. Great tune. Kudos. Well,
yeah, I mean, we definitely were, obviously it leads off the record, so we were definitely about that one, of course. But yeah, and of course, you know, Nuno's I think he's come back with a fury and a vengeance. I don't know, there's a lot of adjectives I've heard describe that solo, but it kind of lit the internet on fire. You know, and so
rightfully so.
Yeah, and it's amazing live now when we play it. You know, I think I had said in another interview recently, it was like Gary, Kevin, and I could light ourselves on fire and no one's going to give a shit or even look at us because everyone's looking at Nuno's his techniques. And it's funny because he said to me recently, he's like, you know, it's funny because everyone's like raving about the solo. He's like, but it's a lot of the similar techniques I've been doing since, you know, since the early days. He's like, if people go back and listen to Little Jack Horny off of Porn Graffiti, it's a similar palm muting technique I'm doing. And everyone's like, I don't know, I guess rediscovering it, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, what? Some of just... it is the songs are so good, though. I mean, I'm a fan and I've listened to you guys. Three Sides was my favorite record that you guys did just as a fan. But I go into a lot of these, you know, no offense, bands that have been around for a long time with kind of like, I'll give it a listen, probably going to listen to it once or twice and then move on and listen to the old stuff again. This was one I like to listen to music when I'm mowing the grass. So I listen, and that's kind of a great place to judge. We're in the car, right? So I listen to the first song, really good. Okay, okay. The second song, really good. Listen to the third song. It started getting like five songs deep. I'm like, hold on a second. Like this, so far, this whole thing's good. So, you know, and I think
that's great to hear.
Maybe to your point is that, you know, maybe you guys just made such a great record that, you know, it's just reflected back to what people liked about you guys to begin with, but it's still so good. And a lot of times, I'll be honest, you know, people will listen to an older band that's been around for 10, 20, 30 years and just kind of be like, eh, it's okay. There's one or two songs I can live with. But this whole thing, we were talking about it before you got on, yeah. Even talking behind your back, it's like the whole thing is super solid.
And sonically, it's fantastic too, which yeah. helps, which makes those guitar parts stick out more maybe yeah. than what, you know, came before. Yeah. But
greater, man.
To his credit, I don't know if you've read the credits, but Nuno did, he produced and mixed it and everything. So he's wow. Many talents. So,
awesome. But you guys did this over 15 years or something, right?
Well, you know, yes and no.
Okay.
Really, the last record came out 15 years ago, but we didn't really get serious about this record until maybe 6 years ago or so, when we started kind of okay. getting together and compiling some ideas and showing each other, you know, some unfinished shit that we'd been working on. And, you know, so we were kind of working on the record. And then, of course, the pandemic came along. And we couldn't work on it that much other than remotely because we couldn't even get on a plane or fly to go, you know, because we did most of it out at Nuno's place in California. So it took a bit of a hiatus, you know, when the pandemic came along. So it wasn't really like 15 years of work. It was kind of like, you know, broken up over the last, like, say, 6 years or so.
You weren't flying parts around just in that interim during the pandemic?
Yeah, Yeah, there was some stuff that, you know, worked on some stuff in my home studio, whatever, and emailed it to Nuno. And, you know, he put some of it in. Some of it didn't, you know, make it onto the record. But, you know, there was a little bit of that. But most of the stuff was recorded out at his place.
So do you have any trepidation about when you make a project this good and this meticulously crafted? Shit, now we got to go play this shit live. You know, it's...
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the stuff, obviously, anytime a band makes a new record and, you know, there's only so much we can fit into the set anyways, because, you know, of course, we're considered one of those, like, I guess you'd call it a heritage act, you know, somebody who's been around for a bit. There's still going to be people that want to hear the old stuff. And, you know, of course, you know, we've been playing, like, say, four or five of the new songs live. There's some songs on the record that probably don't... lend themselves to probably doing them live. Other than, you know, then we'd have to play with a ton of tracks and stuff because there's some stuff with keyboard things. And we're not like a keyboard band, but, you know, so there's some songs that we've been doing that we had released the videos. And of course, those are going to be the ones that people are, you know, more familiar with. So we did add like Rise and Hashtag Rebel and Banshee.
Right. I love Banshee.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That kind of
that sounds like an old Deep Purple tune or something, man. It's just so, you know, rocking mid-70s, except modern sonics. But I love
it. Yeah, it has kind of for us, it kind of seemed like a little Aerosmith swagger to it.
Okay. I could hear that. Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, so some of those songs lent themselves more to the live set, and that's what we've been doing on the road. I think there's going to come a time where we're going to add a couple of new ones as well. And the great thing, like I think you guys were saying, as far as, you know, sometimes bands put out a new record that, you know, a band's been around for a while. And then when they play the new song, you know, people go get a beer, or go take a piss, you know. So
it does happen.
We're finding the opposite, where like people are fired up to hear the new stuff. And, right. you know, yeah. So it's been really cool. We've felt like we've wanted to add more and more instead of, you know, just adding one or two. We've been doing like four or five of them. So
that's unique these days. That's sure kind of to is. My point earlier. It's
yeah.
right. There's bathroom songs, and those usually are the new songs. But the joke is, you know, don't say you're going to play a new song, because that's just everybody's cue to rise yeah. up and get go up. Down the aisle.
Just start it, just barrel house right into it.
Yeah. But to Andy's earlier point about, you know, each song struck him as being really good. Some of my favorite albums I've listened to, and it'll take me two or three listens to the album to kind of have it grow on me. Just listening to this project today, your new sixth album, every song made me say, I've got to listen to this more often. I loved the Hurricane, by the way. A shame you can't have those strings live, I guess. But I thought that arrangement, even the video, was really well mapped, really well thought out. Curious to know who your visual person is, if he's in the band or if you're just surrounded by people that you trust.
So again, to give him credit where credit's due, a lot of it has been Nuno's vision, and he has been directing the videos and editing them as well.
That wow. was, apart from that great location, which right. I've always liked, you know, like Vegas junkyards, you know.
Yeah.
It looked, assuming that's what that was, it just
It has that vibe. It was actually shot out in out in California near Palm Springs. It was in the yeah. like Joshua Tree area.
Okay. Oh, so cool. you brought those props in then.
It was actually they found this amazing location. Nuno and his partner, he has this production and label called Atlantis. His partner Renee, and he kind of found this gem of a place that is like it's actually like an Airbnb if you want to stay there. So this guy wow. has this small home, but all those like antique, rusty, like looking like, you know, old Vegas junkyard, like you said,
yeah.
the old cars, and we actually shot two videos in one day, both at that location. We also did the mask at that location.
Well, yeah. even the
love that.
Yeah. So you'd never know that they were both done the same day, but we literally shot Hurricane, and then that night we shot the mask when the sun went down, but they were both done at that place.
Don't tell me those were shot on an iPhone.
No.
I've seen some really good stuff, you know.
We have this amazing cameraman, named Thor. If you want to check him out, he's on Instagram, Thor God of Bass. He's also an artist.
Cool.
And does like EDM stuff, but the guy's an amazing cameraman. He's done all the videos with us. As a matter of fact, we're doing two more videos this coming week here in Massachusetts. They're all.
I was gonna say, for such a new album, you've got an awful lot of visual stuff.
Well, the idea really, Nuno's determined to want to do a video for every song and actually have
that's great.
A new album yeah. at the end of the whole process. So we're now working, I guess we already have one that we've shot for Thicker Than Blood on the road. That's going to be more of like a live, like, you know, in front of an audience kind of vibe. And right. then we're doing two more this week. So we're more than half done with making a video album.
That's almost the moving pictures answer to an awful lot of what's going on anyway. So many people aren't releasing albums. Gabriel's new album has a ton of EP and single covers for mm-hmm. each song. Even the static images for every song change from song to song. So the fact that you guys have the energy and the creativity to come up with that many interesting visuals is really impressive.
So I'm going to have to check out The Mask, because I haven't watched any of your videos. So I just listened to the record, but man, I love the message of the song. you know, we're all both good and bad, yin and yang.
Yeah.
You know, take off your mask and show me who you are.
Yeah.
Who's underneath there? That's great.
Exactly. Yeah.
Good song.
So I think you'll get it. You'll be interested to see the video once you check it out.
Yeah. I saw the video and I was impressed. I also, as an aside, you know, working with the band Rush, we had a project come along called Counterparts, and it was full of everything from yin and yang, tortoise and hare, slap and tickle, ribbed and lubricated. And just listening to the word pairings, everything from show me who you are, you know, fiction and fact, just listening carefully to the lyrics as I did today, yeah. It was really smart. It was really well done.
Yeah, good lyrics.
Thanks, guys. It really.
But did you really say ribbed and lubricated?
I did.
Is that what I heard? Because I used to buy those in high school. You get them by the 20 pack.
But anyway, those aren't. You know, those are like those kind of wordplay kind of go together.
Well, you notice that Dane said he used to buy them. He didn't say he used.
That's I just I just collected them.
Right. Yeah. I'm just kidding. So speaking of the new record, so tell us the story behind the album cover.
So, yeah. Honestly, it was, most of this whole project has been Nuno's vision.
Right.
And he had seen, you know, he had had the idea of having like the silverback or a gorilla on the cover. And he came across that image. And, you know, kind of, you know, it's obviously that, you know, the expression of is it 800-pound gorilla or whatever is the expression?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, coming in, some of the stuff is a bit heavier, like you had pointed out, like with Rock and some of those songs that have a little bit more testosterone than maybe some of the older Extreme. Mm-hmm. But also, like in looking at the gorilla's face, there's a lot of expression in his face and in his eyes, and really, you know, he's a little weathered and wrinkly a little bit. We're getting older kind of thing. So, you know, as they say, a picture tells 1,000 words. You can stare into that eyes, into his eye, see that face, and it could mean something to different to everybody. But those are some of the things that kind of
that's, you know, cool. Yeah, I appreciate that explanation.
Gorillas are known for being ferocious in one moment and absolutely nurturing and gentle in the next moment, which without being contrived speaks to your music. You move seamlessly between the two modes, you know, when I'm listening, it's just,
well, it's more than two modes too. There's two songs that really surprised me the most. How about the reggae, the Beautiful Girls song? It's like, whoa.
Yeah, definitely.
Left turn of all time, man.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like you guys had said before, and like we've, you know, commented, you know, like on Porn and Graffiti, we had When I First Kissed You, which was almost like a Frank Sinatra crooner, you know. And so that's the whole, you know, expect the unexpected kind of thing. Right. And you know, so that song is a little bit out of left field, but you know,
it's very cool, very catchy.
That's great.
And my favorite song's the last song, "Here's to the Losers," an anthem for, you know, those who won the battle and lost the war. It's very, very nice.
Well,
very,
it's good. Cool, yeah, because that one is kind of the antonym of "We Are the Champions." It's like but the key line, obviously, in that song is, you know, the sentiment is, you have to lose to know what it takes to win, kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
And that's actually one of the videos we're about to work on. We're going to shoot this week. So I'm excited about that one. I'm a big fan of that song too. That was one of my favorites on the record.
People really relate to that. They have to. It's really good.
I love the very end of it too. It was just very, again, great.
The barroom, the barroom sing along kind of thing.
Yeah, but the fact that it goes silent and then it picks up again, that's, you know, I just love that. Yeah. It's like Her Majesty's a Pretty Nice Girl, you know, at the end of
it. It actually reminds me of Salt of the Earth by the Stones. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the drinking song for
all the
regular people, you know. Yeah. Let's drink to the hardworking people stuff.
Yeah.
So, I've never seen you live, so how your vocals are really well thought out, really good. How does that translate from the studio to stage?
So we've been, we were kind of, when we formed back in the, you know, late 80s, it just so happened that we have certain ranges. Like Nuno has a lower range. Gary's always the middle part. And I kind of sing the higher stuff. And it was really just, it fell together even in our early days where we kind of always had those, you know, Van Halen type harmonies where they had those distinct voices and they and you know, we grew up listening to Van Halen, Queen, all those bands that had a lot of harmonies and three part stuff. And so live we've always, you know, prided ourselves in singing, you know, all the, you know, those type harmonies. And so that one was no different than the other ones that we've done where those are kind of, you know, those are our comfort areas and our ranges, and they seem to have, you know, that blend to them. So,
when did you guys actually meet, like the core group of you guys? Because I know the drummers has changed over the years.
So really, there was a band called The Dream back in the 80s that was Gary and Paul Geary, our original drummer. They had a band called The Dream. And at one point they changed guitar players and they renamed the band Extreme. And that was before Nuno had joined. That was in like, you know, I'd say probably 85 or something. And so Gary and Nuno met and they hit it off. And at the time, Gary was, you know, they were kind of looking to make a change or whatever with the original lineup. And Nuno joined in like 86. The band had already been called Extreme, but, you know, when he joined, it really obviously took a big turn because it went from a two guitar band to... And now Nuno became kind of the main writer musically. Gary was writing the lyrics. And then about a year later, I joined in 87. So Nuno and I had met at a custom guitar shop that I used to work at. He used to come in with his guitars. Okay. And so we ended up being friends first. And then, like I said, in 87, the bass player actually had decided he wanted to leave the band. So I basically became Ringo Starr, taking, you know, taking his spot.
Pete Best spot.
Yeah.
Well, that had to be a little weird when your singer goes and leaves or to go sing in front Van Halen at one point. That had to be a little weird, right?
So at that point, it wasn't that Gary left the band. It was like right after Nuno had left the band. Nuno went to pursue like a solo career, and he had made a record called Schizophonic. And Gary and I were kind of looking at each other going, well, now what do we do? You know, and we were talking about, you know, trying to either start a new project like Tribe of Judah or you know, had briefly discussed like, you know, finding a guitar player and continuing on as Extreme. But at the time we were managed by the same manager as Van Halen, by Ray Daniels, who also
manages
Rush. So at that time, you know, Eddie and Sammy and everything, they had their falling out. And so, you know, on kind of a, you know, I remember Ray Daniels asking Gary, do you want to go up and sing and, you know, go meet Eddie? And Gary's thinking to himself, like, this gig's never, I'm never going to join Van Halen. This is like I'll just go up for the weekend, hang out with those guys, and it'll be a fun story to tell my grandkids someday, you know? And Eddie just fell in love with him. And then I remember him calling me saying, Pat, you're not going to believe this, but I think I got the gig. I think Eddie pulled me aside and said, I really, you know, want you in the band. And I couldn't even, you know, I mean, Van Halen was one of my favorite bands growing up. And so it was just miraculous to me. I'm like, how the fuck did my singer of my band end up joining Van Halen? And
were you happy about that?
Great for him, but not so great for you, right?
Well, I said, dude, you gotta go do this. I mean, you can't not do this. So I was happy for him. In fact, it was I went up and visited him while he was making the record, while they were making Van Halen 3. I got to spend about a week up at Eddie Van Halen's house, and it was just the whole thing was amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Course it was a little short-lived, and I don't think it certainly wasn't Gary's fault, but you know, he took the blame for the lack of success for the record or whatever. But
still a good record. I've listened to that record every once in a while. Still got
some. It's just, man, what a position to walk into, though. I mean,
well, that's the thing.
Good Lord.
No, everyone wanted Dave back, And no one wanted a new guy. So,
yeah.
They never do.
Yeah. But they had a fun tour. And now he can tell, you know, he can tell his, you know, his friends and his family and his, if he has grandkids someday, he can tell the stories of being in Van Halen. So
tell us the story, you know, live in this world now and from my seat, you know, promoting shows, when we talk about tribute bands, you know, there was that phase there where tribute bands were just like kind of mocked. Right. And over the years, it's become this thing where it's like, it's not even close to being mocked now. It's serious business.
Almost too much celebrated sometimes.
There's acts like Killer Queen and stuff that they'll go out and play theaters. They're getting paid, you know, 35 grand a night.
The music.
There's things like Brit. Yeah, there's like Brit Floyd or something that doing like arenas.
Yeah.
You know,
totally. Yeah. So tell us about the Dark Desert Eagles project. I mean, you must be a huge Eagles fan, first of all, but tell us how'd that come together.
I grew up listening to Eagles. I grew up listening to all classic rock, you know, like I said, Van Halen, anything from, you know, obviously I was a huge Beatles fan. And, you know, the tribute thing has taken on a life of its own. I think for me, I was originally inspired by Brad Delp from the band Boston. And he had a band here in the Boston area called Beetlejuice. And that was before the tribute band was really a big thing. It was more like they didn't, you know, try to dress like the Beatles or do any of that kind of like Beatlemania thing. But Brad would come out and sing all the Paul McCartney and the John Lennon stuff. And he was just was a songbird, you know. And he was a friend of ours. So I was inspired by that at the time to, you know, I said someday when I, you know, when Extreme breaks up, when I go into my semi-retirement, I'm going to form an Eagles band. And, you know, Extreme has been kind of, as you know, we hadn't made a record in 15 years. And I'm like, okay, well, we play out sometimes. We're kind of limping along doing our old catalog. But I felt like I wasn't busy enough and I had more to give. And I really, you know, after playing bass and singing background vocals for whatever it's been, 25, 30 years, I also sing lead vocal and sing and play guitar. So it kind of gave me an outlet to do that, to front a band and sing lead vocals. And of course, it's a catalog that's just mind blowing. We played a gig two nights ago and it's like, you know, you open with a hit, you close with a hit, and every song in between is a major hit, you know. And so we also do like the Joe Walsh stuff, like Rocky Mountain Way and Life's Been Good. And I don't sing Joe Walsh stuff. I have a Joe Walsh kind of character. But, you know,
when you're playing guitar,
I play guitar. I basically play Glenn Frey's part, but I also sing the Don Henley stuff.
I would have guessed with your high voice, you would have done the Timothy B. Schmidt stuff.
Well, the thing is, we actually portray the Eagles in the 70s. We do the Randy Meisner version of the Eagles.
Okay.
You know, the basically the Hotel California lineup, and you know, like when Joe Walsh had joined the band, they were doing those Joe Walsh songs. We do a couple songs off the Long Run, because you can't ignore that record, but anything after that, we're not doing like their solo hits or their, you know, you're not going to hear the, you know, later stuff, but we do the classic Eagles lineup stuff.
Right.
But it's a blast, you know, you get up and it even goes back to like getting in the basement with these guys and just learning songs. It's like back to the egg of just like learning the songs you grew up listening to. And getting together with the guys in the basement, and there's no stress to it. It's just the hits are already there, and you get out and play, and everyone sings along and knows every word, and it's just fun, you know.
Yeah,
it's
awesome. Yeah.
Do you do the whole of the first greatest hits record, the biggest selling record of all time? So
basically, there's one song we don't do off of that record.
And it's really?
Best of My Love.
Hmm.
You know, so talk about an embarrassment of riches with the hits. That was a number one hit, and we don't do it. I Can't Tell You Why, which was a number one hit.
Oh wow!
You know, okay. So, but you would know every other song, you know.
Awesome,
I bet.
You guys got to play last year, Fenway with Aerosmith, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So what was that like?
talk about a bucket list thrill of a lifetime. I mean, you know, we've done we've been fortunate enough to do some touring with Aerosmith in the past. And even as recently as, like, say, you know, right before the pandemic, we had done some big shows overseas, like in Milan. We did like a soccer stadium with those guys, and you know, we've played with them pretty recently. So that bucket list had already been checked off. You know, they're like hometown heroes of ours, you know.
Yeah.
But Fenway Park was a whole other experience because, you know, it's home, and it's where, as a kid, I sat there and watched the Red Sox, you know, and had a Fenway Frank. So, I mean, here I am standing in center field going, man, if my mother could ever have been here for this, she used to love the Red Sox. And, you know, she passed in 2010. But, yeah, so it was just a thrill to have all our friends. I mean, I looked out in the audience. I see my son, who's now 20. And the look on his face was just priceless. And he's looking at, up at his dad on the Jumbotron and said, maybe my dad's cool after all.
You know? Yeah. Hey, well, that was worth it, right? That's worth more than playing with Aerosmith.
That's it right there.
Yeah.
My first trip ever was to Boston to see them in rehearsal. I flew out with John Kolodner from Geffen, and I had the privilege of doing their Get a Grip cover. So that was,
oh, you did the Get a Grip cover. Cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was actually the one of the tours we did. We supported them a bit in overseas in Europe. And yeah, that was a great record. I love that one.
Really good. Yeah. And the cow, now that I live in Indiana, I can tell you that cow was photographed just down the road from where I'm now living.
So, wow.
Was it?
How did the cow take it when you pierced its nipple?
Well, you had to do it quickly and then get out of the way. You know? Now you laugh, but they did picket Geffen. The animal activists were picketing Geffen because they couldn't fully grasp the concept of Photoshop. So yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, man, it was funny.
It's insane to think people thought that was real.
But I know. Come on.
Yeah.
Well, you guys have a history with Mike Mangini, correct?
Yeah.
Because he's a drummer in Dream Theater. Hugh's done many Dream Theater.
For 20 years now.
Yeah, 20 years of doing their records. So,
yeah.
Where's that connection? Yeah, I mean, you guys got all kinds of little connections there.
He's a good friend. But he had played on either two or three of the songs on Waiting for the Punchline. When we had recorded that in the mid 90s, and then he toured, he did a full run with us. In fact, that may have been the tour with Aerosmith, that Mike was on that tour with us. But then, yeah, shortly after that record, the band had kind of split up, and you know, then when we got back together, Mike was busy with Dream Theater, and Nuno had brought Kevin in. You know, he had played with him on some of his solo stuff, and it's just Mike's an amazing drummer, but you know, Kevin is just such a pleasure to play with. He's such a great drummer.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, you guys sound great together on this new record. Yeah. Fantastic.
Oh, thanks.
And the drums, even. I mean, they sound, all the sounds are great. The production's phenomenal. I'm curious about musicians as they're coming up. Who were your inspirations? Who impressed you as bass players who could sing?
Bass players that could sing. Well, obviously there's only one Paul McCartney.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, obviously Sting. I was a big fan. You know, I learned, or I, you know, as far as like background vocals in a rock band, we had already mentioned Van Halen. Like, I think Michael Anthony, I'd have to cite as one of my biggest influences, mainly just more for his vocals than his bass player. He's a bad bass player, but he's his role in Van Halen is kind of maybe what, you know, kind of inspired me, or that, you know, that they're,
he's a secret sauce of Van Halen.
He made those vocals sound good. If he wouldn't have been on there.
So, you know, as far as just bassists, also Chris Squire from Yes is a big influence of mine. Always loved Chris. Of course, just, I'm not as busy a bass player, but just the guy that, you know, I obviously was, that kind of drew me to bass was John Entwistle.
Nice. Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He had the oddest technique of all time, too. He's almost like a classical guitar playing bass player or something.
I read something recently. Someone who said they were building a bass for him, and they asked, how low do you like your action? And he said, basically in the back of the neck. He liked the action real low. And like,
nice.
Like you said, just a soft little
touch. Just tapped.
That guy was just amazing.
Oh, man. Yeah. Somebody sent me something. I think it was Mike Wunschick from the Mellencamp band, a bass solo that he played from YouTube.
Oh, really?
I can't remember, or just a soloed out bass part three or four months ago. It blew my mind.
Yeah.
You know, you forget how good he was inside those songs.
There's a couple of isolated bass tracks that are out there, like Bob O'Reilly or whatever. And he's just, he's on stage with like his Alembic, Explorer bass. And it's mind blowing what he did. Yeah.
I got to see the last show he played in the United States. I played the concert for New York City right after 9/11.
Oh,
and sure. I stood right by his side of the stage.
Wow.
And they were incredible that. And I mean, the whole show was, it was unbelievably cathartic for everybody that was there. But
of course,
they were especially incredible.
They were incredible. Mm-hmm. And I got to see, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, talking about it. And he was just blazing. Man, he was so good.
I was lucky enough to see him one time on they celebrated an anniversary of Quadrophenia, which is one of my favorite Who records. And that's sat like in like the fifth row and got to see them play that's the album in its entirety. And it was just,
nice.
That was thinking back, that was one of the most incredible shows I've ever seen.
Well, that was when Simon Phillips was with him.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's just a funny aside. I saw when they brought Quadrophenia back after he had passed and, oh gosh,
Pino
was playing. Yeah. So Pino had just joined the band, right? So they were doing My Generation. They did some songs at the end that weren't all Quadrophenia, and he choked on the bass solo. That one, he just choked, and he just looked over at Townsend, and the look he got back, man, I wouldn't have wanted to have been at the after show. Yeah. I'm telling you what, I felt sorry for him. Great bass player, but whoops.
Nobody's perfect.
I saw him nail that solo in Toronto. So,
I'm sure. I bet he never messed it up again. But I did get to hear it. It's like, oh shit.
I saw that too. Yeah.
Was that when
you were at that show?
Yeah. I worked on that show. Robert Plant opened up, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Robert Plant came out and like the very beginning, he walked out with a light behind him and he did this weird like pose. For a long time, it was like, "What is there something wrong with him?" it was really, really
that was a
who was drumming? Was that Zach?
Zach Starkey.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway. So what was your first? What concert did you go to as a fan first, Pat? That you paid to go see that you were like pumped to go see? Where was it? And when was it?
Or that your mom or dad took you to?
Yeah,
the first show I ever really saw that was. Not like just the local band or whatever. I remember my uncle took me to see Foreigner.
Okay.
I was at the Boston Garden. I was just, I was like in middle school, and so I just wanted to see a concert. Like, I had the Foreigner record. I think Double Vision was the record. So that was the first real concert at like an arena that I saw. But I remember, again, I think the one show that completely changed my life was Van Halen Fair Warning tour. It was like 1981 at the Boston Garden. And I remember that night seeing them and the energy on stage and the way they were performing. I was like, oh, my God, that's what I want to do. That's when it just really clicked. And I got,
Yeah.
That was awesome. A big show for me.
I was out there this summer at worked on an event at TD Garden and, Peter Wolf came out and played, and that guy, he's 77 years old and he was moving around that stage like he's 27.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen him before, but man.
Oh, I've seen him. Else. I saw him back in the heyday.
I did too. Yeah.
Man, he was entertaining. Then,
more recently, we played an event, Boston Strong concert. It was right after the marathon bombings. And again, it was one of those, you know, kind of cathartic shows for the entire city. But like Aerosmith played, all the bands from Boston played, like even New Kids on the Block and Bell Biv DeVoe and, you know, all those guys. Let's see, who else was there? Even Jimmy Buffett came into town because he's always been, you know, obviously huge in this area. But we all, Peter Wolf played and Aerosmith and, you know, it was an amazing event. But Peter Wolf came out and he definitely, it seemed as though he was trying to upstage Steven Tyler.
Oh, yeah?
It was pretty amazing to watch. Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Those are two big egos out of Boston.
That's what makes great rock and roll, doesn't
it? That's right. Oh, competition.
Yeah.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Pat.